Good morning. In this lecture and its sequel, which together comprise a single sustained argument, I have four major objectives. First, I want to unpack the concept of passion as it seems to be commonly understood today. Second, I want to show how this popular view of the passions is both simplistic and corrupting. Simplistic because it fails to account adequately for our actual experience of the passions, and corrupting because it hinders us from learning how to govern them in morally healthy ways. Third, I will sketch out what I believe is the much more richly nuanced and morally robust concept of passion articulated in the Bible and in the Christian tradition. And finally, I will propose what I hope is a workable strategy for retrieving the Christian view. Today's lecture will focus on the first three objectives and Thursday's on the final one, but there will be elements of all four objectives in both lectures. Let me begin with a story. One day last August, after working at my desk for several hours, I went over to the gym for some exercise. And as I was standing in the locker room, I noticed a copy of a sports magazine lying face down on a bench. On the back cover was an eye-catching advertisement for a new product, something called Uncle Ben's Rice Bowls. These turn out to be single-serving frozen dinners in microwavable containers. And the ad showed a voluptuous brunette woman wearing a low-cut tank top, spoon-feeding a muscular guy in a knit shirt from one of these bowls. And the caption read, "It was a passion meant to be satisfied quickly." Now, we all know that ads are not meant to instruct us, but to motivate us. Indeed, they motivate us precisely because they don't instruct us. They take as a given what we already believe or assume and use that to persuade us to do or buy something. The last thing an ad wants to do is to make us question our existing beliefs or assumptions precisely because these are what it uses to sell us things. Marketing people are masters of persuasion precisely because they specialize in knowing exactly what people think. They hold up mirrors to our minds in order to influence our actions. That said, I want to use this rice ad as a clue to what people typically believe about the human passions. Let me highlight four things. First, we tend to assume that the passions, a term I shall use to refer collectively to human emotions, sentiments, and desires, and especially the strongest of these, are essential features of a fully human life. They're often annoyingly clamorous and sometimes exceedingly troublesome, but we never doubt that it is good to experience them and proper to satisfy them. We admire the sexy young couple in the ad precisely because their appetite for food and for each other is so obviously robust. One contemporary philosopher, Robert Solomon, has given explicit endorsement to this assumption. Our passions, he writes, constitute our lives. In fact, imagining what life would be like without passions is a common literary device in science fiction. Think of Commander Data, the android on Star Trek who lacks human feelings and desires, has come to regret his misfortune, and travels the galaxy in quest of the elusive emotion chip that will finally make him human. Conversely, someone who has lost the capacity to experience emotion is a pathetic figure. Consider Randall McMurphy, the hero of Ken Kesey's allegorical novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. His irrepressible passion for life so infuriates the personnel in the mental hospital to which he has been committed that they finally lobotomize him. One of his friends, a fellow inmate, takes pity on him because he is no longer himself and suffocates him with a pillow. Another common assumption depicted in the ad that is that our passions are essentially irrational, and therefore that we who experience them are basically irrational too. Passion is not something we can deliberate about or talk ourselves into or out of. Rather, it's a physical craving or animal need that seizes us and demands gratification. We just have it, or rather, it has us. When we look at those two people in the ad, we can't feature them standing in the grocery store aisle comparing prices and reading nutrition facts on product labels before deciding to buy Uncle Ben's. No, their passion must be satisfied quickly, and there's no time for cold calculation. 2 years ago, when I was having my semi-annual midlife crisis, I felt a fierce desire for a hot red sports car. What we actually got was a beige sedan. Not because I was moved by my wife's sweet reasonableness, but because she wasn't moved by my adolescent fantasy. A third thing we commonly suppose about the passions is that they are involuntary. We can't switch them on and off at will like lights, or control their intensity as if they were regulated by some kind of internal rheostat. Rather, the passions are thought to be instinctual and ungovernable. They grip us, drive us, make us do their bidding. They are often pictured as hydraulic pressures inside us that will make us explode if not given vent. We don't intend them. They simply happen in us, almost in spite of us. What's more, they can prompt us to do things that defy good judgment and social convention. We speak, for instance, of doing foolish things in the heat of passion, or even committing crimes of passion. And yet, no matter how badly they sometimes make us behave, we are fascinated by them and secretly envy those who express them uninhibitedly. It was a passion meant to be satisfied quickly, says the ad. And although there is nothing morally admirable about being the pawn of an irresistible force, even an internal one, we smile approvingly that the hungry couple did in fact satisfy it. Fourth, we typically think of a passion as something episodic. It comes unbidden, and then after having its way with us, it subsides. Hunger and sexual desire are both like that, as the ad implies. There you are, busy working at your desk, when all of a sudden, out of the blue, you start thinking of that extra piece of pumpkin pie left over from dinner last night. Your mouth starts to water, and you can't get the thought of its spicy taste and creamy texture out of your mind, and before you know it, you're raiding the refrigerator. And in a few moments, both the pie and the passion for the pie are gone. If only it were that easy to get rid of the calories. Now, how are we to evaluate the view of the passions that I've just sketched out and that I shall regard provisionally as the typical modern view? As I suggested earlier, I believe it is seriously flawed in two ways. It is both simplistic and corrupting. That is, it doesn't account adequately for our actual experience of the passions, or at least for all of them. And it hampers us from developing that mastery over them which Christians regard as morally obligatory. Let me lay out these two criticisms in turn. I have no quarrel with the idea that the passions are essential to human selfhood. Indeed, as I shall show, this idea is crucial to the Christian account of human selfhood. Where the modern view goes wrong is in asserting that the passions are irrational, involuntary, and episodic. Some may be, but certainly not all of them. Romantic infatuation seems to fit that description, but what about the passion that burns in the heart of a happily married couple? Marital love does have its moments of wild abandon and delightful ecstasy, yet it must also be stable and durable, governing not just a couple's bedroom adventures, but also the thousand ordinary routines that constitute marital life, cleaning the gutters, balancing the checkbook, driving the kids to soccer practice, and so on. That kind of passion must be grounded in a realistic assessment of each other's strengths and weaknesses, and it must be intentionally cultivated through the habitual practice of all kinds of courtesies and kindnesses and healthy routines. And it must be held in place by public vows and private promises and shared goals and common convictions and a fund of carefully nurtured memories. So in marital love, we have at least one example of a passion that doesn't conform to the popular stereotype, for the ways in which we experience and express it can be shaped by reason and will. And when people, married people, do infuse their passion for one another with sober thinking and decisive discipline, they stand a better chance of making their marriage last a lifetime. As I shall argue, Christian faith is another example of a passion that is rational, deliberate, and enduring, a passion that cannot and must not be satisfied quickly. That leads me to my second criticism of the popular view of the passions. It's morally corrupting, for by leading us to believe that our passions are irrational, involuntary, and episodic, it suggests that they're incorrigible, unmanageable, and outside of the domain of human control or divine command. If we believe this, we will see no point in learning how to tame or harness them, and we will have a ready-made excuse for self-indulgence and impulsiveness. One of the many characters in Flip Wilson's comedy routine was the sassy hooker named Geraldine, who would absolve herself from her many sins with the tagline, "The devil made me do it." Wilson was spoofing the way in which people sometimes blame their irresponsible conduct on forces external to themselves. But internal forces can also be used for self-exoneration. Thus, the line from a popular song about two people having an adulterous love affair, "If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right." Passion not only causes one to break one's marriage vows, but even seems to override them. One loses even the desire for moral rectitude. "I don't want to be right." And thus one loses any sense of guilt for wrongdoing. That we might learn how to manage our passions or to harness them in the service of our values and convictions, or even perhaps to renounce their fulfillment if that would lead us into more immoral conduct, none of these possibilities are even entertained in this scheme of things. But they're central to the Christian scheme of things. I use the word, and they're crucial, and I use the word crucial, derived as it is from the Latin word for cross, quite intentionally here. For my argument will be that Christian discipleship, which consists in imitating the crucified Christ and striving with his help to bring our own life into ever closer conformity with his, means learning to subject one's own passions to the example of his passion. To make my case, I will need to explicate the profound and richly nuanced understanding of the concept of passion that we find in the Christian tradition. But to do that, I must first draw your attention to two other features of the concept of the passions that are embedded in our ordinary language, namely their transitivity and their narrativity. And here, curiously, the Uncle Ben's ad gets things right. Most passions or emotions take objects. A person is the subject of an emotion, that is, she actually experiences it. But an emotion itself is about something. It has an object. Put formally, an emotion is transitive or targeted. It registers the subject's interest in, attitude toward, concern for, relation to, appraisal of, or engagement with some person, place, or thing. You can see this from the fact that in our ordinary language, emotion words are usually modified by prepositions, which indicate how a person's emotions are targeted, how they fit into his or her life stream. Thus, you can be attracted to a total stranger, jealous of a friend, puzzled by your own jealousy, angry at yourself for flunking an exam, not that mine are that hard, contented with a new job, or anguished over the latest tragedy in the news. And unless you can specify what an emotion is about, you can't make sense of it. Suppose you came to me and said, "I'm just one big bundle of emotions today. I feel jealousy, attraction, puzzlement, and anguish all at once." I would sympathize with you, and then suggest that we sort out these powerful emotions one by one. I would say, "Who are you jealous of? What are you anguished over? Now, suppose you said, oh, nothing in particular. I'm just jealous in general and anguished over everything. Then I'd be stuck, for you'd be defying the logic of emotion words. In fact, you'd be talking nonsense. I might suspect you were pulling my leg, or if I thought you were serious, that the disorder of your emotions was due to some mental illness or physiological cause. But suppose you instead that you can account for your emotions. That is, suppose you can give reasons for them and tell me what they are all about. Then we can proceed. But how do we proceed? By your telling the stories of all the emotionally charged experiences that you have undergone lately. An awkward relationship, a new job, an impossible exam, whatever. And that's the other thing about an emotion. To understand what it's about, how it affects our conduct, we tell stories. An emotion is a byproduct of an experience, and to understand the emotion, one must be able to narrate the relevant experience. That's why psychotherapy, which is all about healing emotional disorders, is essentially a very refined form of storytelling. It's the hermeneutics of the human heart. The reverse is also true. By hearing a story of someone else's experience and identifying with it, we can vicariously undergo the same emotions that the experience triggered or prompted in the other person. That's the secret of great preaching, and great theater, and great literature, which are all very refined methods of telling stories. They use the human imagination to arouse human emotion. Go back to that silly advertisement one last time. It would seem to be just an image and a caption. A photo of two attractive people cuddling up over a steaming bowl of rice, and a blatantly double-barreled statement about their passion and their need to satisfy it quickly. Now, if you think about it, the idea that two people would devour a bowl of white rice as a kind of mating ritual is patently absurd. Yet the ad works because it respects the logic of emotion words. The couple's passion is about something, rice and or each other. And the scenario implies, even if it can't tell, a story, namely the story of what they will do after they finish the rice. Presumably, the same thing is supposed to happen to the customer. Now, contemporary life is fairly choked with stories of this sort. One-sided, one-dimensional characters whose passions rarely rise above the level of primal urges and sentimental affections. With simplistic plots that focus on killing, coupling, and consuming things. With settings that blaze with bright colors and throb with loud sounds. Action movies, sitcoms, music, videos, and TV newscasts are all like that. But notice something else. People today are often impulsive, overwrought, addicted to stimulants of various sorts, and pawns of their own restless and relentless itchings and cravings. I submit to you that it is no coincidence that a world of trite stories would be full of people of unstable emotions. For the stories we tell generate the passions we live by. What would it take to bring harmony to our souls and integrity to our lives? What would it take to arouse what I shall call a master passion in our heart, a passion strong enough to harness and govern our vagrant desires, a passion deep enough to bring wholeness to our fragmented lives? A passion for what is eternally good and not just briefly pleasurable. A passion for what is abidingly true and not just momentarily entertaining. A passion for what is sublimely beautiful and not just cheaply amusing. What would it take to have a passion that makes us wise, resolute, and steadfast? Instead of one that fogs our minds, slackens our will, and jangles our nerves. Here's my answer. To have such a master passion in our hearts we need a master narrative for our lives. By that I mean a very special kind of story. Not an escapist fantasy that takes us to some magical place far away, but a realistic drama that plants us firmly in the here and now, and yet also reveals the hidden splendor all around us. Not a heroic epic that swells us with nationalistic pride, but a sober history that tells us what nasty people we often are, and yet also what glorious saints we can become. Not a self-help manual that tells us how to fix our broken lives, but a kind of treasure map that tells us where to find real gold. Of course, we have such a narrative, Christian scripture. And we have a word for the passion which that narrative awakens, Christian faith. In fact, the central narrative of the Christian scripture is called the Passion Narrative. This is no coincidence. Broadly speaking, Christians have used the word passion or in the singular or passions in the plural in three distinct though overlapping ways. The Greek word pascho and its Latin cognate passio both mean to experience something or to be personally affected by some power or circumstance external to oneself, even in an absolute sense, to suffer something, such as death at the hands of a bitter enemy or cruel fate. All three of the distinct meanings that the word passions has borne in Christian discourse spring from this basic idea embedded in the grammar of the original words that people are subject to or affected by things external to themselves and perhaps outside their control. The first way in which Christians use the word passions is in reference to the sufferings and death of Jesus Christ. Acts 1:3 reads, "To the apostles he presented himself alive after his passion by many proofs." The word used here, topathein, is an infinitive verb used as a singular noun. This is the only place in the New Testament where the word passion in the singular is used with reference to Christ's death, but this quickly became a standard meaning in Christian literature. Bible scholars refer to the passion narratives in the four Gospels, meaning the different accounts of the final week of Jesus' life. And in the Christian church calendar, the period between Palm Sunday and Easter is called Passion Week. I don't need to emphasize the significance that Christians attach to the events of this week: his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, his cleansing of the temple, his arrest, his trials, his crucifixion and burial, and finally his resurrection. These events are the centerpiece of God's saving work for humanity and the focal point of Christian devotion. This is the story on which Christian faith rests, or from which it springs. The second Christian use of the word is quite different and entirely negative. Here it refers to our inordinate desires. For example, the New Testament speaks of the sinful passions, Romans 7:5. When used like this in the plural, the word refers to the various ways that a person can be overwhelmed by longing for what is forbidden or inappropriate. When the word appears in the singular, it usually refers to unbridled sexual desire, or perhaps we should say to the yearning to conquer and possess another person sexually without regard to his or her rights and needs and feelings, as in the expression, the passion of lust, as it's used in 1 Thessalonians 4:5. Yet, the New Testament's indictment of our unruly desires is not restricted to sexual vice. James, for example, uses the synonym cravings in his attack against greed and materialism. Many scholars believe that the biblical authors borrowed this view of the passions from the Greco-Roman moral philosophers, especially the Stoics, who regarded the passions as diseased, irrational impulses of the soul. Christian moral philosophy has often followed the Stoics in naming pleasure, grief, desire, and fear as the most troublesome of the passions, but many others could be added to the list. I shall classify all those urges, emotions, impulses, and attitudes which distort our personality, disrupt our relationships, or distract us from obedience to God as the destructive passions. There's obviously some similarity between the Christian idea of the destructive passions and the popular modern view of the passions, which we discussed earlier. The difference is that the Bible warns us against being ruled by our destructive passions and tells us how to control them, whereas the modern view suggests that passions are natural, encourages us to indulge them quickly, and sometimes even warns us of the damaging psychological effects of suppressing them. The connection between the first and second Christian uses of the word passion is provided by the third. As in the second case, the reference is to human emotions or dispositions of the soul. But here, the specific object of emotion is God, and particularly the crucified and risen Christ. The New Testament doesn't use the word passion itself in this sense, but the idea is present in St. Paul's list of the fruits of the Spirit, which include love, joy, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and, take note, self-control. The Stoics coined the term good passions for those emotions and dispositions which enrich human life in morally healthy ways, a subject of considerable interest in the 18th century, when Jonathan Edwards, for example, spoke of the gracious affections, John Wesley of the holy tempers, Isaac Watts of spiritual emotions, and so on. These various terms have slightly different connotations and resonances, which reflect differences in the author's moral theologies. But all are meant to denote grace-filled emotions and attitudes in contrast to the destructive carnal passions. It remained for the 19th century theologian Soren Kierkegaard to coin a term that indicates the intense zeal and single-minded devotion to God implied in the biblical concept of faith, and yet which encompasses the whole array of religious emotions, moral attitudes, and spiritual disciplines which mark the Christian life. Kierkegaard's term was absolute passion. The modern philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who greatly admired Kierkegaard, put the point succinctly and powerfully in one of his notebooks. "I believe," writes Wittgenstein, "that one of the things Christianity says is that sound doctrines alone are all useless, that you have to change your life or the direction of your life. It says that wisdom is all cold and that you can no more use it for setting your life to rights than you can forge iron when it is cold. The point is that a sound doctrine need not take hold of you. You can follow it as you would a doctor's prescription, but here you need something to move you and turn you in a new direction. And once you have been turned around, you must stay turned around. Wisdom is passionless, but faith, by contrast, is what Kierkegaard calls a passion." I shall follow Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein in referring to faith as a passion, and indeed, as the master passion of the Christian life. However, I do not want to lose sight of the fact that Christians typically experience, and indeed are called to cultivate, a variety of affections: love for enemies, gratitude for blessings, remorse for sins, compassion for those who suffer, and so on. And although these other affections may be regarded in one sense as modalities of Christian faith, it's also true that Christian faith without all of these other things, these other religious emotions or gracious affections, would not be mature and richly textured. Therefore, I will refer to faith and all its appropriate expressions and manifestations collectively as the redemptive passions in contrast to the destructive ones. Thus, we have three distinct senses in which Christians use the term passion. First, the passion of Jesus Christ, his sufferings and death. Second, the destructive passions, the disordered emotions, desires, and attitudes and impulses which cause or result from sin. And third, the redemptive passions, those wholesome emotions, desires, attitudes, and impulses which represent and embody saving faith. My aim on Thursday will be to show how these stand related to one another. I shall argue that in the passion of Jesus Christ, God has given us both a paradigm of the redemptive passions that we are called to cultivate and a power over the destructive passions that we are called to conquer. I will try to show how the master narrative of Scripture awakens the master passion of Christian faith, and how that in turn enables us to master all the other passions, reining in those that impel us to sin and eliciting those that draw us near to God and neighbor. Till next time, thank you.
Dr. Steele, thank you very much. Following Dr. Steele's presentation next Thursday, there will be a chance for discussion. Next chapel, there will be an opportunity to discuss with Dr. Steele in a reception following any ideas that you'd like to pursue more fully. I invite you to stand and let's sing number 568, Take My Life and Let It Be.